Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Steve Erickson, whose latest novel is Zeroville, author of 8 novels, also a couple of nonfiction works, writes politics, and specifically writes on film as a film critic for Los Angeles Magazine and editor of a literary journal called Black Clock. First of all, it seems for this book, Zeroville, that your two interests in writing fiction and in film have completely come together.
Yeah, they've converged here. And my wife keeps asking why I didn't write this book years ago. You know, it seems like a natural, but for whatever reason, this was the time to write it.
The book concerns a character, which we'll go into in a minute, who becomes an editor in Hollywood. Your books always have some kind of fantastic element. When you were putting this book together in your own head, how did those different pieces come together?
Well, this book started actually as a short story that I had written for a McSweeney's anthology, and I wrote it soon after finishing my last novel, which was called Our Ecstatic Days. And I was still kind of in the head of that novel, and it's a very intense, labyrinthine, emotionally roiling book. And I thought that the short story had a good idea at the center of it that I could do more with, but I also felt that I wasn't entirely satisfied with the writing of the story. It didn't have enough of a film energy, if you will. So when I set out to write this book, I followed a lot of narrative laws, if you will, that I don't usually. I decided it should be like a movie. It should be linear. It should always be in the present tense. It should tell its story as much as possible in terms of action and dialogue and movie references, and cuts from short scene to short scene, threw in a few Godardian numbers to class it up. Besides the surreal perspective that the main character, Vicar, has on Los Angeles and has on life in general, he's identified by one of the other characters as being cine-autistic. Besides that, the surreality of the story emerges, I think, more slowly in this book as the story tells itself.
It's also a history of Hollywood film from the early 60s up to virtually the present day. One thing that you do, and I did not have the chance, I kind of had the desire, but not quite the chance, to just sit down with IMDb and come up with all the references. So let's start by there. You have a lot of references to a lot of people. The only time anyone is named is in the context of a conversation one person is having with another.
That's correct.
Never outside that context. So let me throw a few things out for you. Are all the stories in there, insofar as you know, true or close enough to true that they're well-known rumors?
All the movies that are in there, with the exception of one, are real movies, and all of the allusions to those movies or people who were around at that time, particularly from the late 60s up through the early 80s, are true allusions and based on facts to the best of my ability to know them. Now, having said that, is a character called Viking Man.
That seems like John Milius.
Who everybody will identify as John Milius. But it needs to be said here and now that I don't know John Milius. I've never met John Milius. This is my version of John Milius, who may or may not bear any resemblance to the real John Milius.
Well, but the film he makes, a kind of an imitation Lawrence of Arabia, is not the surfing Vietnam movie he actually did make.
That was right, but he did make a movie called The Wind and the Lion, and it was based more or less on that. And the reason that a lot of the references aren't made explicit is that, you know, all of this stuff is being seen from the perspective of this main character who arrives in L.A., as a kind of innocent, only having seen his first movie when he was in college because he was forbidden for religious reasons from seeing those films. The day he arrives in L.A. happens to be the day of the Manson murders, and his head is shaved, so he's a bit of a proto-punk, if you will, and he's got tattooed on his head the images of Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift.
Was that just an image that came to you of a person walking down the street with Clift and Taylor from A Place in the Sun? How did that image come to you?
You know, it was pretty much an instinctive choice. It wasn't one that I spent a lot of time thinking about. It came pretty instantaneously, and there's such presences in that particular scene, in that particular movie, that it just felt natural.
Place in the Sun plays a major part in this book. What is your own feeling about the movie? Along with that, putting aside the semi-autistic nature of Bicker, putting that aside for one second, are his views on films what he appreciates the same ones that you appreciate?
No. I love A Place in the Sun, but that's not why it's in the book. It's in the book because, you know, it has a kind of rapture and what Vicar identifies as a hysteria about it. And in this case, I do agree with his view of the film. That seemed to distill how he feels about movies and the way that I was trying to, without making it sound way more cerebral than it is, the way I was trying to get at how movies have become part of the modern nervous system, if you will. A Place in the Sun is such a dreamy movie, and at one level so deeply irrational, and yet makes some kind of subconscious sense anyway, that it just seemed like the perfect movie. Not to mention, again, the presences. Elizabeth Taylor, who was at her most beautiful in that movie, and Montgomery Clift, who was at his most beautiful. And their love affair in that film also seemed to sum up something about the movies.
The most realistic scene in the book, and the one that just struck me is like, this is real, is when Dottie, the editor, and I guess she's real person.
No.
She's not.
No.
Who actually edited Place in the Sun?
Well, A Place in the Sun was edited by William Hornbeck, who she refers to as working with. But Dottie Langer was a character I made up.
She's discussing editing with Vicar. And when she's discussing it, it reminded me a lot of Walter Murch talking with Michael Ondaatje about editing and Ondaatje's book on Murch.
The book is The Conversations. I read it 3 times. I had to stop myself from reading it a 4th time because I was worried that it was going to influence me too much. Yeah, that's a great catch on your part. It was a key book for me in terms of writing this novel.
When you're writing the book and editing the book to create that feel of a film, were you then using some of materials from that particular book?
Like I say, I was very influenced by that book. I thought I went into the book the first time I read it thinking I knew a few things about movies and realized there were a lot of things about movies that I didn't know. I was also struck, though, at the same time by how film editors make choices similar to those that novelists make.
Absolutely,
in terms of what you leave in and what you leave out and what you're counting on to work subliminally with either the viewer or the reader. But beyond that, I mean, there's nothing in the Murch book about editing A Place in the Sun. That was all my observations and thoughts about it, but informed by what I had learned about editing in general and from that particular book by Murch and Ondaatje.
A friend of mine, Frank M. Robinson, who writes thriller novels, once said to me that, in his mind at least, when he's writing, he said, it's like there's a movie in your head, and if you can make it clear enough for that movie to be in anyone's head, then that's kind of your goal.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a place in the Murch book where he talks, for instance, about a scene in The English Patient, which he edited, where the Ralph Fiennes character is sitting there, and almost imperceptibly a bell begins to toll in the background. And the reason that bell is there is because for the audience, a tolling bell evokes memory, among other things. And it reminded me of all the ways that, you know, you make word choices if you're a novelist, or you take words out or you put them in. Not that the reader is ever going to be conscious of those decisions, but they're going to contribute to a cumulative impact on the reader in the way all the choices Murch was making contributed to the impact of the film on the audience.
As the book progresses, Steve Erickson, Vicar develops his own ideas about what editing is. Part of it has to do with the storyline, which we don't have to go into, but a lot of it does have to do with ideas about the nature of editing. The idea, for instance, that a right and left profile change, and it's different for each person, change the nature of a scene. How does that translate to writing a book, first of all? And secondly, do you buy all of his theories?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I don't know how it translates to a book, and I'm not at all sure I buy his theory. And that was not something that I got from Murch. It was just something that that occurred to me in the writing of the story. I mean, he's also got ideas about continuity and their importance or lack of that probably will remind a few people of some of my other novels, if nothing else. But I have to say that this novel fell into place for me when the character of Vicar fell into place or came into focus, and it was at that point that I could write the story from his perspective rather than writing it necessarily from mine.
Did any sequence happen at Cannes that was as outrageous as the press conference that Vicar goes through?
Not that I know of.
Okay, and he wins an editing award. No editing award has ever been given, right?
Not that I know of.
There's this odd sequence, a surreal sequence involving people wanting to overthrow Generalissimo Franco and a film that they were making. Is that completely out of your head?
That's completely out of my head.
Okay.
I was in Spain during the time that Franco was dying in the mid-70s, and it was a very strange time and place to be.
There's a character named Rondell who kind of breaks off from United Artists. Is he vaguely based on anyone?
No.
But the history of United Artists
right.
broke up exactly like that.
Right.
In talking about the creation of the book, when you bring up films, was there any planning or, you know, a lot of times when I talk to writers, a lot of things are set up and then inside it's all spontaneous as it happens. For you, how much of that was spontaneous? How much of that specifically in terms of certain films was always going to be there?
Most of it is pretty spontaneous. I mean, I did go back and kind of review surveys, if you will, of films that came out in the 1970s.
How conscious were you of the timeline and when films were released?
Yeah, the story is pretty true to a
okay.
real timeline. The films he sees, unless he's going to retrospectives of Fritz Lang or something, the films he sees tend to come out about the time that he sees them.
Is it my imagination, or is there some connection in your brain, some wiring that connects the punk era with the films of the 70s in a way just beyond the same time frame?
Yeah, I think there must be. I hadn't planned on the whole punk subplot, to be honest. It sort of presented itself. It seemed natural that Vicar would become a part of it.
The Passion of Joan of Arc, that's a real film?
Yes.
And is it a film? I've not seen it. Is it a film I need to go on Netflix and get?
Yes. It's one of the dozen greatest movies of all time. And it's available from Criterion on DVD.
Is the film as constituted the alternate version of outtakes as opposed to the real film?
No, it is the real film. I think we have to put quotes around real because Carl Dreyer, the director, is not here to tell us, but the film had existed as a compilation of outtakes. That was the first version I saw at a time when nobody knew there still was a master edit, if you will. And the master edit, which I don't want to say too much more about, it was discovered in a way circumstantially similar to what happens in the novel.
Wow.
That's
amazing.
In a janitorial closet in an Oslo mental institution in the early 80s.
Does that give you hope that maybe somewhere along the line there's someone will find the Magnificent Ambersons?
Boy, that would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
You're listening to an interview with Steve Erickson, whose latest novel is about film, and it's called Zeroville. Steve Erickson, let's talk about your work. How did the film critic gig come into place? Was that always happening simultaneously to your novels?
A certain amount of cultural commentary was always happening. I always wanted to be a novelist, and I consider myself a novelist. My day job going back to the late 70s has been as somebody who's written about music and film, and occasionally books. I kind of stay clear of books just because I'm writing them, and it's too much. But I wrote a lot about music, and I've written a lot about films. Particularly since the early 90s, I've written more and more about films, and I've had several film gigs now.
What do you think is the difference between reviewing and criticism?
Criticism, yeah. Well, criticism, I mean, reviewing is a consumer-oriented endeavor. That is, you're advising the consumer, the reader, the person who's going to go out and buy a ticket for the movie, whether the movie's worth seeing or not. I think critics try to talk about ideas that are informed by certain films or refuted by certain films. And, you know, without sounding utterly pretentious about it, they're trying to draw a larger context, if you will, to put these movies in, while hopefully not getting so cerebral and erudite that they lose sight of the visceral appeal of movies.
In my mind, one of the differences is that a critic, by being a critic and putting it in a critical context, seems to me more able to have spoilers, because you have to analyze a film as it exists, whereas a reviewer has to be very careful, and too many reviewers, I think, would rather give plot than say what a film is actually about.
Yeah, I don't actually talk about plots that much, and occasionally my editor will come back to, who's a great, great editor, the best editor I've ever had.
Who is he?
His name is Kit Rackless. We'll come back and say, you know, maybe you need to tell us a little more about this movie. I mean, I know when I read about movies, I'm not interested in hearing a blow-by-blow account of what the plot is. I'm not talking too much about the narratives. I'm talking about other things that are going on in the movies, again, that support or don't some larger case that I'm trying to make about movies in general, or culture in general, or society in general.
What do you think is the relationship over the course of the past 6 years, 7 years, between the horror that we're seeing coming out of Washington and film today?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think the movies have tried to put as much distance between themselves and what's really going on as possible. And, you know, we're seeing now this rash of Iraq films that apparently aren't doing very well. And, you know, in fairness to the public, I don't know how much I want to go see movies about Iraq when, you know, it's, as you say, it's a sort of ongoing nightmare that we have to deal with on a daily basis. I'm not sure how ready I was for all the Vietnam films that came along 5 years after the Vietnam War was over. You know, movies are always walking this fine line, I think, between providing an escape, which I think is perfectly valid, and also, you know, moving us, which is clearly a higher aspiration.
Currently, after what I look at as a fairly dismal year in film, with, you know, maybe the exception of Ratatouille, we're suddenly getting some movies. One is Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Haven't seen that.
There Will Be Blood.
Haven't seen that.
American Gangster.
Haven't seen that.
And Sweeney Todd.
Haven't seen that. There's Charlie Wilson's War, and there's the Coen brothers.
No Country of Old Men.
Right, right. It coincides with the calendar. There's always this sort of rash of important, quote-unquote, films at this point, and so some of them pan out and some of them don't, and there's always too many to absorb. I gather that Atonement, based on the Ian McEwan novel, is sort of considered at this point the front runner for the Academy Award. At least that's what the LA Times is telling me. I have seen that, and I think it's an honorable but flawed film, and would hope that, I know that it's not the best thing I've seen this year.
What is?
I like the Ang Lee movie. Nobody's talking about it much, and it's a pretty intense movie, and I don't know that I would ever want to see it again, but Lust, Caution, I think it's worth seeing. I like the new Wes Anderson movie, The Darjeeling Limited.
When talking about Oscar, at this point in my mind, and I have my own theory, I think American Gangster is going to win the Oscar for Best Picture because it's that combination of good reviews and audience response.
Right.
You know, you go back 25 years, the only film that wasn't a blockbuster film or the closest thing to win an Oscar in all those years, looking at numbers, was Crash. Right. And it strikes me that the reason Crash won was...
they didn't want to give it to Brokeback Mountain.
Right.
Yeah, I think that clearly they did not. They couldn't bring themselves to give it to Brokeback Mountain. I should say, I did not think Brokeback Mountain was the great film that that other people did. I would have preferred it winning the Oscar over Crash, which I didn't hate. I may be the only person I know who didn't either love it or hate it. But as far as American Gangster is concerned, there is this sort of, you're starting to hear this emerging buzz that Ridley Scott is this year's Martin Scorsese, that this would all confirm your theory, that he is this year's Martin Scorsese and that he's way overdue for a director's award, and American Gangster is the movie that's going to get it for him.
From what everything we know, speaking of Ridley Scott, is Deckard a replicant?
Well, Ridley Scott clearly thinks he is, and Harrison Ford clearly thinks he's not. And this was the crux of their conflict, I gather. I think it's a little gimmicky. The movie always worked perfectly well for me with Deckard not being a replicant, especially given that she is, the Sean Young character.
When you're looking at film today, how do you think it compares, the overall state of American film compares to, say, American film of 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, obviously the 70s and 30s were special times.
And the 40s. I think the film business these days is very schizophrenic. I think the dichotomy between the studio movie and the independent picture grows and grows and grows. In a way, what was going on in independent films felt a little more vital 10 years ago, but that's probably because there was still enough of the shock of the new about it. I have to say, especially having just written a novel about it, that I think the 70s are a bit overly romanticized, and that not all the movies we remember as great are necessarily great.
Like what?
Well, like Midnight Cowboy, for instance. Certainly like Easy Rider. I have much more complicated feelings now about Robert Altman than I did 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I adored him, and there's a couple of his films I still adore. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I think, is a great film. The Long Goodbye, I think, is a great film. But I'm more ambivalent about Nashville than I was when it first came out. And I think there is something a little smug about some of Altman's work. And having said that, you know, I have nothing but respect for his rebellion, you know, and for his determination to go his own way.
Steve Erickson, you've also written about politics.
A Leap Year was about the 1988 campaign, which I was convinced was going to be this fabulously interesting campaign. And 1996, where I was originally hired by Rolling Stone to cover the campaign, and did for about 6 months. So my running joke now is that I only cover boring campaigns, and that'll probably leave me out, unfortunately, of this one coming up, because I don't think this one coming up is going to be boring.
What's your perspective on the Republicans and Democrats? My own feeling is the Republicans, they're all losers, but someone has to get in there.
Right. The Republican race right now resembles a Democratic race. I mean, the dynamics that are at work in the Republican race are the kind you usually see in Democratic races. Chaos and a complete mystery in terms of how it can all possibly turn out. The Democratic race, like most Republican races, is much cleaner and much clearer, I think. I think it's definitely going to be Hillary or Obama. I think that Hillary is the odds-on favorite. I think Obama is the only one who could knock her off. And if he doesn't do it, then I don't think anybody will. I suppose there is a far-fetched scenario that Hillary collapses somewhere in around New Hampshire if she was to do poorly in Iowa, and Obama can't get it together enough to take the nomination away, and you wind up with a deadlock, in which case Al Gore steps in. But that doesn't seem probable.
and Edwards is out of it.
I don't think Edwards is going to make it. He's too invested in Iowa, and Iowa has become a no-win situation. Unless he were to win commandingly, unless he were to win by 10 points, I don't think a victory there means anything, and if he loses, he's done.
And over in the Republicans, right now it's Giuliani, but I mean, I can't see fundamentalists, and they're the rank-and-file workers going for Romney,
yeah,
which somehow the mainstream press doesn't get.
I agree with you. Giuliani, it's very hard for me to believe that the most right-wing major political party since the Civil War is going to nominate its most liberal nominee since Wendell Willkie. I don't see that happening. Romney is completely inauthentic. It's difficult for me to believe that the evangelicals are so desperate not to nominate a McCain or Huckabee that they would choose a Romney. The irony is that Huckabee aside, the authentic conservative in this race is McCain, and the conservatives won't have him, you know, because he's not a lapdog. And he's probably the Republicans' strongest candidate in a general election as well, because he's got a life story that nobody can touch. Interestingly enough, McCain's fortunes, I think, ride to a certain extent on Hillary's. If Hillary wins Iowa, then the Democratic race is probably virtually settled. And in New Hampshire, all of those independent voters, which right now constitute half of the New Hampshire voters, all those independent voters who might have somewhere else to go, like Obama, might be lured to voting, to getting into the Republican mix and voting for McCain. I think if Obama were to win Iowa or run ahead of Hillary in Iowa, it hurts McCain.
As someone who's covered politics for so long, you have your own take on this question. It's the one that I ask people, and a simple one. Why are the Democrats such wusses?
I don't know. The answer you don't want to give is, or the answer you don't want to believe, is that there's something in their DNA as a party that makes them that way. And I promise you that if voters go into those voting booths in November of 2008 believing that the Republican nominee is going to do a better job of protecting the country, they're going to vote for him. It's hard to fault them for that. I think this is the one thing that Hillary has figured out, and this is why she's running the kind of campaign she did. And you saw, you know, up through the spring and into the summer, you know, Obama was steadily catching up with her and closing the gap and was raising more money. And then they got to that first debate, and I'm saying all of this as somebody who, if I had to vote today, would vote for Obama. But they got into that first debate, and Brian Williams or whoever it was asked the $64,000 question, you know, what do you do if another American city is attacked by terrorists? And everybody kind of, you know, Dennis Kucinich did his Rodney King thing, why can't we all get along, and we don't have any enemies. And you know, Obama basically said, you know, I call the fire department, you know, and Hillary said, we find out who did it and we retaliate. Boom. And, you know, she has figured out that if she's going to win this, she has to run as Margaret Thatcher, a moderately liberal Democrat Margaret Thatcher, but Margaret Thatcher. And that is, she's going to have more testosterone than anybody else in the room.
And in terms of how the media is covering this particular campaign, do you think it's any better or any worse, the same personality junk or what?
Yeah, it's too soon to really know. I mean, the media does get caught up in the horse race aspect no less than I just spent 5 minutes talking about the horse race aspect to it. I think that the Republican contest is a source of real confusion for you and me and the media alike. And I think the media, just like the candidates, are trying to sort out to what extent this is a change election and to what extent this will be a national security election and to what extent this will be an Iraq election. And now, you know, with the mortgage slash housing crisis going on, to what extent this will be an economic election.
I keep thinking when I'm watching all of this and following these campaigns over the years, the one question the media never really gets to is, and obviously they didn't do it in 2000 for whatever reason. They didn't do it in 2004. In fact, they haven't done it insofar as I can remember. And it's the question that we should all be asking. Who would make the best president?
I think that's the obvious question that, as you say, never gets asked. And I don't know why that is. I also think that, you know, with each passing election, more and more the question emerging is, you know, what is the meaning of America? When the Ann Coulters of the world, you know, accuse me of treason, my answer is damn straight. You know, I am a traitor to Ann Coulter's America because I'm a patriot of another America that I believe in. And this administration, and, you know, you have to take a deep breath, I think, when talking about this administration, because the subject lends itself to a certain amount of hysteria. But this administration has cast that question in ever starker terms. I never thought that, you know, we'd actually be debating in the United States Senate whether it was okay to torture people. I thought that question was beyond the pale. Whatever party you were in or whatever ideology you were, I didn't think that question was ever going to become a relevant question.
Do you think as a novelist you have any specific responsibility?
This answer will sound more vague than I think it is. I think my responsibility is to be as good a novelist as I can be, and that is going to involve raising certain questions, addressing certain issues, not necessarily being a political writer, but aware of the world that I'm living in. Whatever talent I've got, that's where it lies. And I feel responsible beyond whatever other ways I might be involved from a civic, social, political standpoint. I feel responsible to do what I'm good at as well as I can do it.
Steve Erickson, now Zeroville is out. Are you working on another project?
I'm not. I'm taking a break. I mean, I've kind of got my hands full with the film writing and with the literary magazine that I edit and with my teaching and raising a couple of kids. So,
well, then let's, before we go, let's ask one question about the literary journal Black Clock. What is it, and what are you looking for that's distinctive to Black Clock?
Yeah, you know, I'll know it when I see it. I was asked by CalArts, California Institute of the Arts, where I teach, to put together this literary journal. It's not a student journal. It's a national literary journal. We've had in our pages Don DeLillo, Richard Powers, Joanna Scott, Jonathan Lethem, William T. Volman, a lot of renowned writers. And yet at the same time, while assembling the stars, I do feel an obligation to reflect some sensibility, maybe even go so far as to say a West Coast sensibility that isn't getting reflected by some of the other journals. We're still evolving. Our eighth issue comes out in January, and you know, like I say, I'll know when we get there.
You've been listening to an interview with Steve Erickson, whose latest novel is Zeroville. This evening, 7 p.m. at Black Oak Bookstore in Berkeley, I will be introducing Steve to an audience, and I'll also be talking to him a little bit more like this, as we're doing today. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.